Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you need a CPA that you can trust with all your taxes and financial needs? Look no further than Joanne Flash Fleming at Fleming & Associates CPA. For more info, go to flashfleming.com or email Joanne directly at joannfleming at flashfleming.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Ooh, I like the way you do.
Hey, hey, guys. It's Heritage Radio Network's Eat Your Words, and I'm your host, Kathy Irway. It is another sunny 65 or so degree day here in Brooklyn in February, and I'm in great spirits today. I don't know about you guys. It could be the early spring that we're having, but it is also the 299th episode of this podcast, so I'm really excited about that. I'm really grateful that... Yay, guests. I'm really grateful to get such amazing food writers on the show next week for the 300th episode. It's going to be a fun surprise. I'm really looking forward to it. But today, I'm really excited to have an amazing writer. She's been a cookbook author, but she's also been a New York Times correspondent and a passionate home chef. And she's also a novelist, multi-talented woman. Her name is Jennifer Steinhauer from the New York Times. How are you, Jennifer?
Hey, it's about 7 degrees in Washington this morning. I'm sitting on my back porch as we talk in the tank top, so it's kind of crazy.
I'm not complaining just yet, but we'll see how we feel when it's midsummer, perhaps. Yeah. So, Jennifer, I'm really glad you could join us. We had a great lineup today. We're talking about A Meatloaf in Every Oven, which you co-wrote with Frank Bruni, your colleague at the New York Times. And it is about you and Frank's conversations about meatloaf making over the years working together. And it's a charming cookbook. It's really interesting and really thoughtful. And it's all about meatloaf. I love it. By the way,
that does sound oxymoronic, but it's not. It's not. Frank and I just have always had our shared a love of meatloaf. Me as a home cook and cooking for kids, and him as someone. Frank is someone who can't. He's not that terribly skilled in the kitchen because he's spent a lot of his career as a professional eater. And going out to restaurants.
Food critic.
Former restaurant critic, as you know, and former Rome bureau chief, where he ate out a lot, obviously, enjoying on the road all the foods of Italy and beyond.
And,
but he can make meatloaf.
Yeah. And it sounds like a passion project of both of you. And just as a note, Frank is was going to join us, but he's on a plane right now, again, traveling, you know, for work. So it's so great that you could join us as in addition. But so first things first, Jennifer, you've been at the Times for a while. And I've heard things about how it's failing, perhaps.
Right.
What do you have any thoughts on that? Like, how's it actually doing? Like, let's talk about that, because there's a whole, like, sort of renewed sense of mission, it seems, for journalists. And what is your thoughts on that? Do you have an inside?
Well, we're failing with thousands and thousands of more digital print subscribers since President Trump took office. So it's an interesting way to fail, with more fans and more people paying to read the New York Times and other newspapers, I might add. So I think journalism is definitely has been a maligned profession and also a financially embattled profession. But right now it's something that people are coming to really appreciate. as they look to newspapers in particular, but all forms of media to inform them about the new administration. And I would say that while journalism remains a difficult business model, difficult profession, we are pretty far from failing based on readers alone.
Mm. Yeah,
and
that's
very engaged readers, I might add.
Very engaged and also very passionate reporters and correspondents. It sounds like, do you guys feel like a little bit like heroes these days? I mean, it's a very, as you said, it's a maligned, you know, sort of profession. I saw in Forbes it was like the number one worst job to have in terms of pay and security, job security.
Probably true relative to other professions. I don't think journalists feel like heroes, and if they do, they should think about that, because really there's nothing that about our job that's changed. It's just the environment that's changed. Maybe the subject, obviously, in the White House is very different from other presidents, other elected officials that we've covered. But I don't think that it's really about our egos or our heroism. I think just people putting their heads down and trying to get to the bottom of things. I mean,
yeah.
The thing is, in this case, you have a president and people around him who have engaged frequently in a disinformation campaign to talk about events that never happened, to go well beyond spin, which is a natural bipartisan product of any administration, federal or otherwise, and to be expected, and it's mm-hmm. the journalist to check that. But
yeah.
This is something beyond that. This is actual, frankly, lies. And so journalism has had an important role
right. In
pushing back on those lies and trying to disseminate the truth whenever possible.
So it sounds like, you know, you guys are doing what you do, what you've always been doing, but it has a renewed or a kind of a more urgent need right now and given the climate
I think some people are experiencing it that way.
We just want to make sure you guys are okay. That's basically
I think
all
we're okay. Okay. I think we're fine. I mean, we're not
thank
you know
you.
It's a one-way war here. We're not no journalists are at war with the Trump administration. He has called us the enemy of the American people. I don't think many people actually believe that, to be honest. And he seems to be attacking journalism and the media a lot and with a broad brush. But I don't think journalists look at the Trump administration as the enemy. They look at them as the subject. And it's one of many subjects.
Yeah.
And this is the subject that everyone's turning a lot of attention to at present.
Right, right. Well, you know, it's great that the New York Times is doing so well in terms of the digital subscribers. That alone is that's a whole other story. You know, how do we monetize the news these days? But, it's great to hear that so many people are getting behind you guys. So congrats to that. Let's move on. So you guys have been talking, you and Frank have been talking about Meatloaf for several years throughout working together at the Times. And it sounds like these were sort of, you know, water cooler conversations. You know, oh, I did this one day. And did you try mixing the breadcrumbs this way or so forth? Is that how it?
Yes.
Yes.
We don't have a water cooler, though, because, you know, Frank and I have not worked in the same city for many years now. We did meet at the New York Times in New York, and we were both there. And then Frank subsequently went on to Rome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then he came back and he was a restaurant critic, and that was when our friendship kind of really solidified, because I was a very happy diner at any of his tables.
Uh-huh.
And so he didn't count on me even at the last minute to come fill a table, and we became
right.
fast friends. And then I moved to Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
and Frank would frequently come out to dine there, and I was his dining partner and buddy there. And then from there I went to Washington. So a lot of our relationship has really been on the phone
mm-hmm.
over
okay.
the past few years
yeah.
and by email, obviously, and text and so forth. But so our water cooler is our telephone and our dishwasher,
right.
because we talk a lot while we each unload our respective dishwashers on Saturday mornings,
mm-hmm.
and we frequently talk about Meatloaf.
Mm-hmm. And you guys haven't, like, it sounds like you've dined out a lot. You know, Meatloaf isn't really something you see in restaurants too often.
We've been discussing that a lot since this book came out. It was very interesting. The Nomad Bar, I don't know if you know that, in New York. I've been featuring our meatloaves and our sides from the book this month, which is really fun.
Well, that's
Both to have them doing that, but just broadly to give attention to Meatloaf, which you're right, is basically like a diner meal or an afterthought. When Meatloaf does seem to have a role to play both in the panorama of comfort food. We've kind of been plowing through this last decade, and people seem to be returning to it in recent months.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But also, you know, Frank, Frank and I both, but especially Frank, for obvious reasons, were able to turn to chefs that we'd known over the years to ask them for meatloaf recipes. And what was amazing was so many of them had them in their repertoire or were willing to develop them. They liked the idea of playing with it, too, which tells me that chefs can enjoy actually having meatloaf as an offering on a restaurant menu.
Yeah, it sounds like this Meatloaf Manifesto is proving that its appeal across the board, you know, and across the globe, too. I love that you write sort of when you're looking through the history of meatloaf. You write that the meatloaf was a home for not just scraps, but for spices that connected it to the cook's Epicurean ancestry. One old American recipe combined veal, ham, and breadcrumbs with grated nutmeg, mace, and cayenne and lemon rind for a decidedly French flavor profile. And you have a whole section here about meatloaf around the world, you know, from Alex Guarnaschelli's mom's meatloaf to a Korean-styled meatloaf to a French-styled, a Japanese-styled meatloaf with miso and mirin. I mean, so you really are taking this as a sort of blank slate to, and it sounds like that is that has always been the case, looking at the history of all the different variations. I mean, meatloaf is like anything you want to make it. And
it's true. It was the international component was a little bit of a combination of things. Some cultures we learned in our exhaustive research of meatloaf and all things meatloaf-like have their own sort of version of it, like kebab, which is in various Middle Eastern countries serve that.
Uh-huh.
And then we found this kind of prune loaf that was interesting from a very specific
prune?
Region of France, and then bobotai from South Africa, which is actually done in a casserole dish. But it really is very much like a meatloaf with a custard on top, which was really interesting to us. And from there, we also realized, as you pointed out, that meatloaf can be a palette for other flavors and spices. So you mentioned that one was mirin. I mean, I worked on that for a while, trying to emulate dishes that I had in Japanese restaurant. Of course, Japanese culture does not have any meatloaf that we ever found. We interpreted with these Japanese flavor profile to make a meatloaf. And that was also true with, I call it the Jewish Christmas loaf, which is using Chinese spices, like five spice powder and other flavors, to have a meatloaf. It's a beef meatloaf, but it invokes Chinese food.
Because that is what the Jewish eat on Christmas in New York City.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes, and elsewhere. Los Angeles, too. A little bit D.C., everywhere.
Okay. It's become its own thing, its own tradition here,
and
uniquely American.
Chinese food and movies on Christmas for Jews, definitely, I think that's almost what you would call an American tradition at this point.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So meatloaf is one of those iconic dishes, you guys point out, along with hamburger, which is kind of similar, or at least shares the same sort of raw ingredient. It's something that we think of as iconically American. Obviously, you know, what is iconically American anyway? You guys trace the roots of it back to a sort of scrapple created by German, you know, immigrants to America, and, you know, pretty early on. And it was actually more of a breakfast dish. But, you know, I guess it's hard to describe what is American food now. If we're talking about something that is so malleable, it really kind of brings home the thought that, you know, nothing is set in stone and nothing is absolutely American or absolutely one way or another. I don't know.
That's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. I mean, I tend to think this is a very narrow way of looking at it. I want to just say that caveat right up front.
Mm-hmm.
But the cookbook I did before this was on making homemade snack foods, and I was looking at, you know, kind of like the history of Hostess and Little Debbie and all these different kinds of junk food, if you will, or snack cakes, and creating them in your home kitchen. And I learned a lot about them. And a lot of them, like meatloaf, too, are very connected to the war effort. And interestingly, with the snack cakes, a lot of those things were sent to soldiers, you know, to sustain them.
Uh-huh.
Meatloaf also in the, I don't know, during World War II, post-World War II time, you had this tradition, two traditions in the American kitchen. One is, you know, trying to find ease, right? And the other was stretching things, stretching your protein, stretching your meals. And meatloaf really is a real protein stretcher. You're putting binders in it. You're putting other things in there. You're trying to take your meat and get it, you know, across the line for a family dinner for, you know, four people, five people, six people. And that's, to me, is an element. It's not the only one by any means, but that's an element of a traditional American food, is how it relates to war periods and periods of conservation and periods of sort of trying to make the most of what you have in your fridge, if in your home, if you will.
Right, right. And also maybe innovation. You know, it sounds like this this recipe or this dish, meatloaf, became a lot more popular after industrialized processes of grinding meat up became more widespread, and it was more easy to find. And you know, by the 50s, it was everywhere. But, you
yeah,
know,
that's
different
very true.
Steps.
And packaging, too. Those two packaging, as you point out, wisely, the moving into industry in terms of meat grinding and things like tools, but mm-hmm. also ways to package things and to preserve things for longer. Those
right,
are both
right.
key elements, I think, to these inventions.
There's so much to talk about in meatloaf, but let's cut to a quick little commercial interlude and be right back chatting more with Jennifer.
From your chalice chest and I bow my head to you.
Are you filing your own taxes and driving yourself crazy? Do you think a professional can do a better job of finding legal deductions? Do you own a business and need help with the accounting and taxes? Are you a not-for-profit business that needs financial guidance? Are you just plain tired of your boring accountant and looking for some fresh eyes? Try Fleming & Associates CPA. At Fleming & Associates, Joanne Flash Fleming can quantify anything in a flash. She'll do your taxes, assess your worth, and is even a forensic accountant, an investigator of white-collar crime. Joanne Fleming once said,
"It was terribly hard for me to read Moby Dick, but put a financial statement or tax return in front of me, it's like a novel."
Imagine that. Has the political and financial news got you feeling down? Joanne Fleming was the accountant for the Occupy Wall Street movement back in 2010. Who better to trust with your financial secrets? For more info, go to flashfleming.com or email Joanne directly, joannfleming@flashfleming.com.
Hey, hey, we're chatting with Jennifer Steinhauer. She is the author of a best-selling cookbook, Treat Yourself, as well as the co-author of the new cookbook, A Meatloaf in Every Oven. And she's also a veteran correspondent for the failing New York Times. So we're talking all about meatloaf. This is so much fun. You guys, it sounds like you guys kind of like have some strong opinions about what a meatloaf is and isn't. So, you know, you're just talking about stretching meat you know, the virtues of reusing up scraps. And I love, Jennifer, that you're, you know, you call yourself a passionate home chef. So you're not a trained chef, but this is something that you make. You actually make this often for yourself and your family. Is that right?
I do. I mean, chef would be, I say cook, home cook.
Yeah.
I would say, and out of necessity, right?
Home, you know, chef, home cook. Yeah, I see what you mean.
With your kids, you can't afford to go out to eat all the time.
Right.
And so I've tried over the years to make dinner more interesting through different picky phases and different food trends, different times, you know, with the economy going up and down, paychecks going up and down. Meatloaf kind of endures all of that. You can make meatloaf high, you can make meatloaf low. We do have some kind of ideas about how to improve upon what's sort of the traditional meatloaf.
Okay.
Principally, the main thing that Frank and I kind of insist upon that breaks from tradition is that we really want cooks to saute their veggies, particularly their onions, their aromatics, and their uh-huh. garlic. You know, a traditional meatloaf has this chopped raw onion, which I think is part of why meatloaf gets a bad rap. You know, some people just really don't like the texture of that, and it's kind of mouthful of
goo,
you know, cooked in there. Yeah, there's like weird chunks. So I think really both of us just went from almost every single loaf in the book that has an onion, which is most of them, we always start in the pan. You know, it's a little extra step, but get those onions sauteed, and there's other vegetables, get those sauteed. It really lifts the flavor, the texture, and the sort of the elegance of your loaf.
Mm. Elegance, yes. Okay, all right. So what about ketchup? How do you feel about smearing ketchup all over the top and baking it like that?
So ketchup obviously doesn't belong in all of our loaves. I mean, first of all, you know, with nearly 50 loaves in here and from around the world with Japanese flavors, Chinese flavors, some of these loaves aren't meat at all. You know, there we have a couple tuna loaves in there.
That's really exciting.
And vegetarian loaves.
Yeah, that's...
You know, ketchup doesn't belong in those at all. Ketchup does not belong on your ahi tuna loaf. Let's just get that right out there. But you know what? Ketchup can lift... I still love a good ketchup glaze.
You do.
Especially like a ketchup, brown sugar, traditional type of glaze. I think it's delicious. One of my meatloafs that my kids ask for a lot is really just a meatball that I make that I one day put into a loaf because I had too much of meatball batter left. It's got ricotta cheese, Parmesan cheese.
There's an efficiency to a meatloaf,
I love to put a little ketchup on that. It really gives it a little zing, and it makes it transforms it from a meatball to a meatloaf, I think.
Yeah. Well, I love it how, you know, quick and easy it sounds rather than forming all these balls and then browning them all around, and then, you know, you just stick it in the oven, make a loaf.
Yeah, right?
Slice it up.
It's just exciting. You're right. The balls can be... I'll put a little side note, though. Lately, I've been kind of just brining my meatballs up a little bit and finishing them in the sauce. And I must just say, I think that is a much easier way to make a meatball. I truly digress here.
The
meatball is the mini meatloaf, if you will.
I'm all for this. So you don't cook it all the way through. You just get a nice little crust and then let it soak up the sauce? Does it kind of get more plump when it cooks?
Yeah, it does. And sometimes, if you don't have a good tight ball, they'll break a little in the sauce. But... Mm-hmm. It's just that I keep it simmering in there for a good while, you know, to make sure it's cooked all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a method that I've really cottoned to in recent years.
Cool.
Frank likes to say that as a sapling is a tree, so is the meatballs the meatloaf. So a meatloaf is just a grown up meatball. Just going to put that out there for you.
Got it. So another tip that you guys have is it goes hand in hand for meatballs, I think, too. At least that's what I do with my meatballs. It's you take rather than dry breadcrumbs you mix into your meat mixture, it's taking some wet bread, soak it in milk or something, and then you kind of mush it all around, and that'll give it a more fluffy texture. Is that what you found with meatloaf?
Yeah, so that method isn't best. It doesn't work for every loaf. You know, some of our loaves and some of it, it's not. You know, but you're bringing this whole interesting, you're opening this whole binder door, if you will.
Binder door,
there are so many doors. we're through the binder door now.
Uh-huh.
We're in there. We see bread. We see dry bread. We see milk-soaked bread.
Egg?
We see saltines. We see cornflakes, which is a very specific flavor. One loaf that we developed, I'm just in love with this loaf. I don't know if you've ever been to Charlie Bird. Restaurant in Lower Manhattan. They have a farro salad that I just dream about at night.
Uh-huh.
And I want to try to get that into
a meatloaf. I'm looking at that right now. Okay. Charlie Bird turkey loaf with farro.
Yes.
Okay.
And so the binder there is cooked farro.
Yep.
And it works fantastically. That loaf takes a little time bit longer because, you know, farro takes a little bit of time to cook, you know. So it's just a little more effort there.
But you cook it first.
Chopping for some of that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, rice, we have rice as a binder. A Frito pie loaf.
Uh-huh.
The corn chips are the binder. So you have a lot you can work with here.
This is fun. So this is the binder. You got a whole world of binders. Let's talk about...
I would say universe of binders.
Okay.
It's beyond. It's
okay,
like
we're
so
beyond.
Satellites, everything.
I'd like to know the outer space binders, maybe in the sequel.
That's exactly right.
I'm looking forward to it. So you also have a whole section of meatless meatloaf, which sounds wrong in every way, but, you know, what else are you going to call it? It's really exciting. How did you guys, who came up with the idea for doing that, first of all? Was this just like a sort of creative challenge? Did you just feel like doing more Meatless Mondays? Why would anyone do a meatloaf?
It was kind of a practical / inclusive effort, if you will.
Okay, yeah.
Because we knew we had to get, you know, between 40 and 50 loaves, and we were going to be doing that. And we thought, well, what about for the person who is a vegetarian and actually wants a loaf option? And, you know, even for us, for nights, we don't want to eat meat. What can we do with a loaf? It was just like a creative challenge, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And we did have two chefs weigh in on this, on the total vegetarian ones, Daniel Patterson who is a chef out in San Francisco, who I met when I lived in California, and he has not a totally vegetarian by any means, but a vegetable-centric restaurant there.
Okay.
Really sophisticated, elegant, beautiful things that he does with vegetables, and his zucchini loaf is really delicious. I have to say, it's a loaf. I like meatloaf and Franklin's meatloaf because you can kind of mess with it, you know. You don't have to be exact. That one, you have to grate that zucchini. I tried to just ribbon it, I think, the first time around, and the structure was all messed up, and I had to go back to my basics. Similarly, interestingly, Michael Schwartz's kasha loaf with the caramelized onion gravy.
That looks good.
Definitely one of the more challenging ones to do and to create, and I really give the chef a lot of credit. He worked hard to work with us on this loaf just to get the structure right so that it would hold together. So that's an intense one, and then you also have an opportunity to work with beans and lentils and things like that. I didn't want that chapter, you know. Honestly, and we have some other interesting fun things with fish.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I didn't want them to be. You know how like you go to a restaurant and then with a vegetarian friend and there's one vegetarian thing on there, just grilled vegetables, and you're like you want to throw up, you know?
Like
I didn't want those loaves to be that. I wanted those to be something that was
cool,
that you could feel just as happy to feed your guests as, you know, some of the more indulgent meat-based loaves in the book.
I love it. I love that there's an illustration here of a tuna fish swimming through a piece of bread for that recipe with tuna.
So Marilyn Pollock-Narrow, and she's such she's an illustrator. Do you know I met her on Twitter?
Oh, really?
She would post her food illustrations.
That's so wonderful.
On Twitter, you know, just kind of randomly, like her, you know, little, and they were so beautiful. And I said, well, gosh, we should see if you could be the illustrator for this cookbook. And I was so happy that Grand Central caught into her because she has such a creative way of illustrating in a very beautiful way and a very fun way, the kind of the joy of meatloaf, if you will.
Mm. You guys clearly have a lot of fun with this, and your work comes into the last chapter here where you have a meatloaf dedicated to Paul Ryan. Oh dear, Speaker Paul Ryan's loaf. And it's dedicated to Paul Ryan because he's such an avid deer hunter, which I wasn't even sure about
that. It's his recipe, actually.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
I can tell you how this came together. This is a funny chapter. So this is the political postscripts chapter.
Yeah. There's one for Chuck Schumer.
What's that?
There's one for Chuck Schumer. I'm just giving folks a glimpse, a taste, if you will, and Nancy Pelosi and so forth. The political meatloafs.
They are. And these are all authentic family recipes. The genesis is kind of funny. So I cover Congress for the New York Times. That's my day job. That's what I do. And I frequently will visit with Senator Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, about cooking because she loves to cook. And she really likes to talk about cooking. In fact, she's the sponsor of this Thursday group where Republican senators come to have lunch meeting on Thursday, and they each take turns representing their state, the food. And it's really fun. And I'm always talking to her about whose turn it is to cook that week or to serve when not really cook. But she's a big avid home cook. So I was telling her about this meatloaf book at its inception, and she said, oh, you really should include my mother's meatloaf. It's really the best meatloaf in the world, and it's got this horseradish, and it's a pretty much a classic meatloaf, but it's got this little twist. And I said, oh, that would be great. Just as she promised, she hand-wrote it out and got me a JPEG of it through. And I said, okay, this is great. Then fast forward about a month when Paul Ryan became speaker, I went to his office to interview him, and he said, I heard from my staff that you're writing a meatloaf cookbook. Is that really true? Because it's kind of a weird side job, you know, for a political reporter.
Sure, sure.
I said, yes, Mr. Speaker, that's true. And he said, well, you really should include my meatloaf.
He's very proud of it.
Meatloaf.
Yeah.
And I grind my own meat when I kill my deer. And,
wow.
You know, it's not a fancy loaf at all. It's got Lipton onion soup, as you know, many of the traditional meatloafs do. But sure enough, I work with his staff. They sent me kind of the outlines and went through it.
Because
kind of more in his head, you know?
Yeah, and he approved.
And then I reached out to Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer so we could fill out a bipartisan chapter. And, you know, I didn't know what I was going to find. And sure enough, bizarre, they each had family meatloafs. They're all different.
Everybody loves meatloaf. They're all
very representative of them.
You got Senator Susan Collins in there. Omnibus loaf, and I love that you have side notes about each of them, like Paul Ryan cooks and his wife does the dishes.
That's right. He told me that was kind of like part of their marriage contract. That was pretty funny.
I might also add that Paul Ryan's recipe includes one envelope of Lipton Recipe Secrets onion soup mix. So maybe that's a secret, which you have shared with the world. This is so much fun, Jennifer.
Thank you.
You know, meatloaf is and should be fun, and it's not something that you see too often, although you did point out, you know, some exceptions where people are seeing meatloaf in restaurants, but it's not something you see too often, you know, exalted to, you know, the upper echelons of fine dining. And I think that's, you know, I think that's what is something you can embrace when you're making it at home, is that, you know, everyone can have their own type of fun with it.
Whether
you're a speaker of the house or whatever.
You can go with a Lipton soup mix and a ketchup on top, and that's a fun meatloaf. Or you can go, like if you want to look at one of the more complicated loaves in the book, whether it's a chef's recipe like a Mauro Bocelli, where you're, you know, a rolled meatloaf, or again, the kasha loaf, which is very time consuming and very advanced. So you can offer a lot of different things to different people. But ultimately, you know, I think what you're getting at, too, is this still kind of remains this maligned American tradition. You know, Frank fell in love with this loaf that he developed, actually. It's called Cheesy Chorizo. And he serves it at dinner parties all the time now. And he always tells this funny story about how when he pulls it out of the oven, his guests, kind of their face kind of falls. You're serving us meatloaf. Then they eat it, and they're so excited. You know, it's delicious, actually. I mean, who doesn't, you know, people who eat chorizo, it's delicious. And they're happy and thrilled that he served it. And it's just getting past the visual of, oh, my gosh, you're serving me meatloaf, right? It's actually delicious.
And anyone can have their own twist on it and put their own, you know, national cuisine signature on it, which is a lot of fun as we're, you know, celebrating so many different ethnic cuisines. At least I am lately, in response to various things
going on
in the world. You know, it's this really, I think, will hit home for many people for the nostalgia, but will also be exciting for creativity's sake.
Well,
thank you so much for joining us again, Jennifer. It was great to have you
on.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for your interest in meatloaf.
Absolutely.
Maybe they'll heal us all.
Yes. Let's hope it gets a little colder so we can have more, you know, kind of cold meatloaf appropriate nights this winter.
Wonderful.
All right. Well, thanks again. And thanks everyone at Heritage Radio. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.